President of the United States of America, authorized by an act of Congress, March 3rd, 1863, has awarded the name of Congress the Medal of Honor to Corporal Michael J. Crescentz. Corporal Crescentz distinguished himself by conspicuous gallantry in actions while serving as a rifleman with Company A. In the morning, his unit engaged a large, well-entrenched force of North Vietnamese Army, whose initial burst had pinned down the lead squad and killed the two-point men holding the advancement of Company A. Immediately, Corporal Crescentz left the relative safety of his own position, seized a nearby machine gun, and with complete disregard for the safety of his own life, charged 100 meters up a slope towards the enemy bunkers, which he eventually silenced and killing two occupants each of the next three or four machine gun nests. Corporal Crescentz's courageous movement forward towards the fourth bunker, which he received gunfire when his M60 ran out of ammo, and he was silenced. He lost his life guarding Doc Stanford and a wounded veteran. He used his body to shield them. Sudden intense machine gun fire erupted from an unsewn camouflage bunker, realizing the danger to a fellow squad. I don't need to read this. I know it by heart. Corporal Michael J. Crescentz went over to the medic, the medic was tending to the veteran, and when a fourth machine gun bunker opened up, Mike, 19 years old, used his body to shield Doc Stanford and that wounded, and they both lived, and of course Michael lost his life, and right now he's the only recognized Medal of Honor recipient from the city of Philadelphia during the Vietnam War, and there are a few more that should be getting it, and we're having those investigated, but I'm sure Michael would enjoy the company, and Michael would be the first one that would say, yo, Joe Griffey's. I'm not the only hero from Philadelphia. There's a lot of them. Joe, are you with us?
Yes. Yes, sir, Big Joe. How you doing, pal?
How you doing, my friend? You are, let me see if I get it right, Charlie, Michael,
Peter,
then you, Peter, and then Chrissy.
Then me. Then Steve, who was the
Steve and Chrissy
guard,
after you, yeah.
And then Chris, the youngest.
How old were you when the knock came on the door, John? You answered the door. We, you know, I think about this all the time.
Yeah, I was 12.
You were 12 years old.
In seventh grade at St. Athanasius Catholic Grade School in the West Oak Lane section of Philadelphia.
Mike was what, 19? Went to Cardinal Dougherty?
Yes, sir. He was 19. He graduated Dougherty and Joe in 66, a year after you and my brother Charlie.
Yep, Charlie and I went together. Charlie, your oldest brother, Marine in Vietnam, who just recently passed away, state policeman in New Jersey. And
Yes, sir.
And Joe, are we doing enough in our country for our Gold Star families? I mean, they make the biggest sacrifice in the world.
It's funny you're saying that to me, Joe. I was invited to an Army-Navy gala with the special forces that they were honoring down there in Baltimore the night before the current Army-Navy game down at the Baltimore Stadium this past December. And the funny thing was, I know there were other Gold Star families there, but I personally didn't meet any of them, which was fine. You know, I kind of wish I could have met some of the younger parents and or spouses of our men that were killed in action in these global wars on terror. And but hopefully someday I'll get to meet some of these other people. But back in our day of me growing up while you guys were in the service overseas, there was really no support for the Gold Star mothers or Gold Star fathers, as a matter of fact, or the families, period. Because Vietnam was, of course, getting the ugly press of the 60s, you know, the mid to latter 60s into the early 70s. And the press really did you guys a great injustice. And I saw that as a kid growing up.
Joe, wait a minute. Our country did. Our state did. Our city did. Our VA did.
Oh, yeah.
Our employers did.
Yeah.
Colleges put signs in the window. We accept the GI Bill except from Vietnam veterans. Go somewhere else. I just wrote an article in the Doug Satterfield's blog, The Leader Maker, one of the best articles written on the internet, and he does it every day, and every so often I write an article for him, and I wrote in there that no other group of veterans in the history of our country so far, and hopefully as long as Vietnam veterans are alive, we won't allow it, has ever been treated with such disrespect when they came home from war as Vietnam veterans.
Let me say one other thing
before you go on. If Mikey was here with us, he'd be so proud of you, Joe, for the legacy and how you lead your life and your family and your kids, and how you uphold the Crescent's name to honor your brother Michael, and you should be applauded. You're a dear friend of mine. You're the friend. Logan, we're waiting. Ralph Galati will be on at 3. He's at St. Joe's at a Shark Tank event, and Bill is on his way here now. We've seen his granddaughters play soccer. But Joe, you were our very first. You were our very first guest. Next week will be 15 years. You were our very first.
Wow.
You, Father Spidell, and Rita. The county clerk,
Rita Fulginetti. Fulginetti or something. Yeah.
But you know something, Joe? I'm writing another article. I just wrote an article that'll be published next week about how Vietnam veterans were treated when we came home, and tried to tie in the six veterans that are landing any minute. Probably they may have landed already. The president is at Dover, I believe, and the dignified transfer. And hopefully we're going to get a phone call from your friend and my friend, Patrick, who's down there covering it. He's going to call us after 3 o'clock.
Yeah.
God bless him. Isn't he the best?
Let me tell you, Joe. Now, there's a guy, you never hear him speak. You never hear him boast about anything. He just wears his Marine Corps aura. He's the total package, and he's such a humble man. that went on to live a life that most of us would wish, you know. He's just, I can't say enough about Patrick and what he does for our veterans and for our KIAs, our wounded warriors. The man's unbelievable. He goes all over the country, and it's like he doesn't ask for anything.
No, he's down at Dover now. He's down at Dover now, and trust me, these pictures will be on our Facebook page and his Facebook page probably tonight when he gets home. But, Joe, I want to bring something up, and I was talking to General Satterfield, and he said, don't forget you owe me an article. I owe everybody, Joe. You owe me an article for Memorial Day. I said, whatever you want, General. So it got me thinking.
Sure.
You know, Memorial Day is a day that we lower the flags to half-mast, and it's really a day that our flag turns in to a memorial of remembering. There's a proper word that escapes my mind right now. I must be getting old. I am old. It's a time to memorialize the veterans that have passed, and that's what Memorial Day is all about. And you fly the flag half mast till noon, then you raise it up for the rest of the day. But it's a solemn signal to our country through our flag that we're honoring the ones that died. And it got me thinking, you being a Gold Star, 12 years old, getting a knock on the door, your dad's upstairs shaving, 7 o'clock in the morning, your mom's in the kitchen.
Yep.
Cooking bacon and eggs for you, Chrissy, and I guess it was...
Steve.
You, Steve. Steve and Chrissy. And the knock comes on the door, and your dad yells down, Joe, see who the hell's at the door? Now, you're living in a little row home, and your dad yells down, Joey, see who the hell's knocking at the door at 7 o'clock in the morning? Your dad's up in the bathroom shaving. Your mom's in the kitchen cooking breakfast.
Correct.
And you yell upstairs, Dad, it's a man from the Army. And, Joe, can you tell everyone what the next sound you heard in the house was?
Yeah, I heard a drop. It had a big clunk sound on that floor that we had in the kitchen. It was a frying pan that Mom was making, whatever she was making, like fried potatoes, bacon, whatever. And heard that drop and silence, dead silence. And my father come rushing on down the steps, and he said, no. I mean, he had such a blank look. He knew exactly what that knock on the door was. And then Mom, she was never right. Mothers are never right.
And you know, Joey,
from that time forward,
I wrote an article just yesterday for Doug Satterfield. And I wrote about there's two kind of knocks on the door. There's a knock on the door from the mailman, from the UPS guy delivering a package, FedEx guy delivering a package.
Right.
And there's a knock on the door when your buddy's coming, knocking on the door to say, do you want to come out and have a catch, play ball? And then there's another kind of a knock, or there's another kind of a doorbell that rings. And that's the one telling you that you lost a loved one. And it got me thinking. And I said, you know, General Satterfield, veterans never go.
When you walk storm, hold your head up high and don't be afraid of the dark. At the end of a storm, there's a golden sky and the sweet silver sound of love. Walk on through the wind, walk on through the rain. For your dreams be tied.
Welcome back, everyone. WIBG 398-1020, the Welcome Home Show. Joey, I came home. 69 or 68, was it, Michael?
November 20th is 68, Joe.
68. I came home in July of 68. So that Michael caught that. He was a year behind us, you, Charlie, and me in Dougherty. And I got to tell you something. The education and the discipline that he got at Dougherty is what taught him to do what he did on the battlefields of Vietnam.
That's correct.
You know, I often say when somebody's doing what they're doing, the only person that's out there with them is God. You know, and
amen.
You know, and amen to that. You said something about mom and dads and brothers. The same with brothers too and sisters. Their life is never the same. They're always, you know. I wrote an article yesterday, and what I wrote in it was, you know, that empty chair, that place setting that's not at the table. Even though Michael for many years was at the table with your mom and dad, but he wasn't sitting in a chair, he was sitting in their heart. And I said the same thing about the doorbell. When the doorbell rings or the knock on the door comes, and if it's, you know, the mailman or one of your buddies, one of Mike's buddies knocking for Mike to come out because he loved to play baseball, come out and have a catch or whatever, that knock is different than the knock we get when somebody wants to come out and play. I mean, that ring of the bell and that knock has a different sound to it. And like you said, Michael was awarded the recipient of the Medal of Honor by, I think, President Nixon in the White House.
Right, Nixon in April 7th of 1970.
Yeah, and you weren't allowed to go. You had to stay home and babysit.
Yeah, I had to stay home with my two younger brothers, those characters, along with my Irish grandma, my mother's mother, who was married to that World War I Marine.
Mrs. McLaughlin. Grandma McLaughlin.
A tough old Irish lady, boy. She didn't take any nonsense, that's for sure.
Joe, do you think at 12, and what was Chrissy, 10?
No, Steve was nine, and Chris was just turning 8. He just turned 8.
Now, you're 12. Do you think you really understood what was going on?
Yay and nay. Yeah, I saw a lot of Mike and Charlie's old head buddies from the neighborhood. They all disappeared off the street corners, you know, and you know, they all had graduated high school, of course. But you didn't know where they were going, where they were working, learning a trade. Who knows? Nobody thought about going to a college, that's for sure. Most went into a trade or picked up a job before they decide what they wanted to do with their lives. And then Uncle Sam called for some, you know, some got drafted. Most of the men that I have met from your era of being military veterans have volunteered. Most that I have met have volunteered to go into the service.
Yeah.
So there's that nonsense that's always written that there's a lot of draftees, but yeah, there was a lot of draftees, I get it. And but there were also many more volunteers.
Yes, there was, and they state that. Now, I was drafted. My brother volunteered 3 months before I did. But, Joe, I'm looking at an article right now. Hey, Bill. Bill just got here with his Wildwood jersey on. And I'm looking. And it's on the front page. A warrior gets his due. A war hero gets his due. A statue of Michael K. Santione, Philadelphia resident, awarded the Medal of Honor for his actions during Vietnam War, was dedicated this week in Philadelphia Vietnam Veteran Memorial Park at Penn's Landing. The statue was sculptured by Chad Fisher. Krasenz was awarded the medal posthumously for eliminating 4 machine gun bunkers that had halted the advance of his company. The 19-year-old Army Corporal was a 1966 graduate of Cardinal Dougherty High School. The Philadelphia VA Medical Center was renamed for him last year. And this date of this paper was April, my God, 10 years ago, April 28th, 2016. The Michael J. Krasenz VA Medical Center now was renamed for just the VA, Philadelphia VA Hospital. And the Michael J. Crescent Memorial Foundation with Tommy Roberts and oh, come on, I went to school with him. What's his name?
Like Bill Crane, maybe?
Bill Crane. Bill Crane. Bill Crane. They're the ones that were behind that, raising all the money. And it's a 9-foot bronze statue of Michael holding a M60 machine gun. Did you ever see that picture, Bill? And just fabulous about your brother. We just can't say enough about your brother. What do you think Michael would be doing today if he was with us, Joey?
Well, I think he'd be doing just like most of the men that I met, including yourselves, you and Bill, who I don't think I ever met that's on the show, or Uncle Ralph Galati. God bless his soul, what he endured. I think he would have had a big family. I think he would have liked to have had a lot of kids. He probably would have doted on his grandkids. He would have been involved with their lives, maybe, you know, athletically, you know, because he was a good athlete himself, like most of the guys were that day.
He would have been down at the Phillies opening game.
Oh, my goodness, probably, because he loved, I think we all grew up loving baseball back in that day.
Yeah.
You know, baseball was the sport, you know, at that time.
You know, we all came from middle-class families, and you only needed a pimple ball to put a game together.
Correct. And you played in the sandlots. I mean, or in the playgrounds, you know, at the public school, nearby public school playgrounds, shooting hoops and playing stickball. Any of that those crazy games we played in the city, you know?
but Memorial Day's coming, and we want to dedicate our time, and you know about the Flags of Liberty and the Sun Joy flag, and Susie Hulse bringing her mother's POW MIA flag. And Bill, I don't know if you know, I think I'm pretty sure you know that Joe's mom and dad are buried in Cape May County Veterans Cemetery.
Yeah, and Joe, we did meet at the Irish pub a number of years ago. We had some good.
Oh, there we go. I'm sorry, but if I see your face,
Joe's getting old, Bill. You got to forgive him.
Yeah, well, that's tough on the radio, and you'd recognize me because my hair is always combed.
And I don't have hardly any hair.
Yeah, I don't have any at all.
And how is Val doing, Joe?
She's doing fine. She's actually in the bowling lanes. I'm sitting out in the parking lot talking in my truck here so I can talk to you guys and hear you. She's helping out our youngest daughter with this foundation. They're raising money for people who've lost their loved ones to fentanyl and whatever other opioid drugs and this and that that's a scourge on our country. And so she's helping out, you know, what she can do. She embroidered a bunch of shirts and all that stuff to sell for this foundation. So, and she's doing good. God bless her.
And we had a great bowler on last week. Ed Doherty, Vietnam veteran, got wounded, came home.
Yes.
And he had a choice of playing Major League Baseball, Major League Bowling, or Major League Golf. And
good athlete.
Yep. Great athlete, and now he bowls in a league, and he's doing pretty well, and that's good.
Good.
Listen, we got to go to a break. Yeah, I want to reach out to you, my friend. Go ahead.
I wanted to let you know that Phil Doherty, I met him at a golf outing from the Philadelphia VA over there and some golf course in South Jersey to help our paraplegics. Guys that lost a limb, you know, to whatever.
That's Johnny C. And the name of that program with Rita Chappelle and Johnny C. It's called The First Swing, and they teach blind veterans.
That's it.
Blind
and
veterans.
I had the pleasure of meeting him. And here, what was funny, he was in Michael's unit. He was with the 31st Infantry, the 196th Light Infantry of the Army, just like Michael.
Yep. Johnny C. teaches veterans that have prosthetic arms and legs and are blind to play golf. And
correct.
He's a good friend of Ed Doherty. Joe, real quick.
Sir.
A hospital's named for Michael. The VFW post on Martins Mill Road's named for Michael. put a statue up with the great Terry Williamson down at the Vietnam, and Dennis Best, the Vietnam Veteran Memorial, and they're both Marine Vietnam veterans. There's other streets. The street in 46th Street in Landis is named for Michael. I'm sure there's many, many other things in Michael's honor that the city has done, and I know you're a great representative of the, not only your family, but of your brother. And
well, thank you.
And he'd be very, very proud of you, what you do, my friend.
Well, thank you very much, brother.
You know I love you, brother.
I love all you guys, and just remember, guys, let's pray for our troops overseas.
That's right.
Back home safe.
And Patrick Hughes is down there now at Dover.
The
dignified transfer. Listen, hang in there, all right?
Very good.
I'll see you soon.
God bless you guys.
All right, my friend.
All right, see you
listen to the Welcome Home Show. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. WIBG 398-1020, Welcome Home Show. Bill just arrived. Hal, your granddaughter, they won the championship?
No, it was my old high school, Wildwood High School.
Oh, Wildwood High School. I thought it was your granddaughters were playing.
Smallest group one high school in the state. Seeded number two beat the number one team.
Now they go on to the state championship. They won South Jersey, and that's an award by itself.
That's great. We got two great Americans. One's an Army vet, one's an Air Force vet, one's a man, one's a woman, and one takes care of our kids, and one takes care of our veterans when they're passing on. Claude Schmidt, are you with us?
I'm with you, Joe. How are you?
Fine, sir. How are you? We've been talking for a lot of years. We finally got you on the show, and we're honored.
Well, thank you so much.
You run an organization called The Last Patrol.
Yes.
Now, I will be attending a film
presentation 2 weeks at the Homedale Vietnam Veteran Memorial, and that's called The Last Patrol. And they were the guys that went to Washington, and Philadelphia has the last patrol, that they also went to Washington to scratch the names off the wall to bring them back to Philadelphia, brought it back to 648 from Philadelphia. And New Jersey, the last patrol brought them back in the 1,566 names, I think. We just added a name last year, and another name we're adding, I believe, this year. And they're called the last patrol. But you're the last patrol at the end of life, aren't you?
Yes, we're technically called Veterans Last Patrol, and our mission is veterans in hospice care. We befriend them, we honor them, and we support them with a volunteer network around the country. So we focus on, as you say, on the last chapter of life, what we call the last patrol.
Claude, where are you? You're in 40 states, your organization, correct?
Yes, we have volunteers in 40 states right now. We have our headquarters is in South Carolina. But as I believe I shared with you, I actually started the organization, at least the idea of the organization, in New Jersey. So I was born in New Jersey, have a connection there, and so that's kind of where it all got started.
Whereabouts in Jersey where you're from, Claude?
I was born in Mount Holly.
Mount Holly. I used to work in Mount Holly.
Yeah.
Mount Holly's about 10 minutes from Philadelphia, right on 38.
I was just in that area this morning.
Is that right? Yes, yes. That's where I was born. And my last assignment in the Army before I retired was in the Fort Dix area. So at that time, I started to volunteer for veterans in hospice care. I learned about the need and pretty quickly found out that there were just far too many lonely veterans in end-of-life care. You know, they sit often by themselves in nursing homes or in their private homes, and they sadly have fallen out of the veterans community, most of them, and kind of get forgotten, disappointing to me and you and so many Americans. And so what we're trying to do is bring more attention to that category of veteran that is isolated, lonely, usually elderly, and on their last patrol.
You know, Claude, I'm going to say something. I hope it comes out right. And if it doesn't, the hell with it. Don't worry about it. A lot of the veterans that we deal with today, whether it's Bill, you, me, Ralph Galati, a lot of them are forgotten about during their lifetime. But whether they're in hospice with you, and a lot of them, my good friend, her name will come to me. She's also a volunteer at the Honor Flight in Philadelphia with Andrew and Kathy.
Mm-hmm.
She's been doing
good organization.
She's been doing hospice for many, many years. And that veteran that might have been homeless and ill his whole life and separated from his loved ones, his family, probably doesn't even know if he has grandkids or not. That last couple days in hospice or last month in hospice, you do such a great job. You make up for a lot of that lost time. You might not be able to put his family around the bed that he's dying in or his grandchildren, but the people that work for your organization, Last Patrol, he wouldn't know the difference, the love that they give. And that's so important. I want to thank you.
Thank you, Joe.
I want to read something. When American veterans go into hospice care, they often lose contact with family, friends, and with the military community. Some are alone. Some sit quietly in nursing homes. Many families are loving and attentive to their hospice patients, but appreciate getting the support, connection, information that friends and military communities can provide. Last Patrol helps provide that support. And do you have a number where people can make a contribution to you? Because, Bill, don't you think what they're doing is so, so important?
It's extremely important. I spent a couple hours in a nursing home a couple days ago, and I met a few veterans in there, and they're all by themselves, and they're just anxious to talk to somebody and spend a few minutes. And they're proud of their service because they wear hats.
Absolutely. Yeah. They are proud, and so they really feel that connection to the military brotherhood, and what we're trying to do is just enhance that and expand that into that special category of those that are on their last patrol. Hospice care is typically considered about the last 6 months of life. You know, it can be shorter, it can be longer, but they're hospice care providers all over the country, and they all need, and that's where we come in, try to bring them more veteran volunteers to visit those patients.
Clay, can you share us a short story that you may have witnessed over there. And how many years have you been doing this?
So we're going in on 7 years of volunteering and providing this nonprofit support. You asked about our contact information. So it's veteranlastpatrol.org.
And give that phone number.
Yeah, lastpatrol.org. And our phone number is 864-580-8005. And we're active on social media. So if your listeners are on Facebook or Instagram or any of those, LinkedIn, we're out there. And, of course, as I said, the website is veteranlastpatrol.org. But, yeah, we've got a lot of stories. I'm happy to share one with you.
Share one with us.
Okay. Well, I'll give you one of my very first ones. And this was a gentleman in the Cherry Hill area of New Jersey. And I was visiting him for some time. He was alone. Before I met him, his spouse had died. So he was recently... became a widower shortly before I met him, and he had no other family. He had a caregiver who visited him during the day, but other than that, he was largely alone, and so I would start visiting him once a day. He was a World War II veteran, and he had been a landing craft operator going into Normandy on D-Day. And, of course, we talked a lot about his war experiences, his life experiences. He shared a story with me that one of the landing crafts adjacent to him going into Omaha Beach got shot up. And the crew members of that craft went into the water. And my friend's name was Joe. He jumped into the water and rescued one of his fellow Navy sailors in the adjacent landing craft. And those guys then, as you can understand, became a lifetime friend, lifetime buddies, and the gentleman he rescued sent him a box of cigars for like 42 years, every anniversary of Joe's birthday. So just a wonderful relationship I had with them. We just talked, you know, you just go and listen and talk. And I remember each visit would always close by, I would tell him, Joe, you have a good rest of your day. And his reply was always the same. It would be, you have a better one. So it's just, I remember him and so many others like him.
Listen, when you stay on with us, Claude, and Claude's number again, if people want to make a donation, because nobody gets paid at his organization, it's 864-580-8005, and that is the last patrol. J.P. Miller, are you with us?
I am. Good afternoon. How are you?
Hi, J.P., you're on with Claude Schmidt and Bill Davenport and myself. And where are you at now, J.P.?
I'm actually in Metro Atlanta area.
And you are an Air Force veteran of 8.5 years?
Yes. I actually did 8.5 years.
8.5, and then another 8.5. And now you're waiting 8.5 years to get from, what are you, at 90% or 80% to 100%?
I'm at 90%.
90%. Right, I think that's the biggest crime in the world, Bill.
It is.
You know, what a waste of government money. You're going to get it. You're going to get all the back pay. But in the meantime, we'll spend $1 million trying to check T's that aren't crossed and I's that aren't dotted to hold you up from getting 100%. But we're going to work with that with you, I promise you.
Okay.
You know, you cost me a lot of money. My wife wants to buy all your books now, so you'll be getting an email from my wife probably tomorrow. Now, we have Claude on that's talking about the end of the life of a veteran. You know, mm-hmm. there some could be young, but the majority are probably 80, 90, 100 years old.
Mm-hmm.
You're doing your veteran that's skills right. differently. You're writing books for who? Who do you write your books for?
I am. After I got out of the military from active duty, and then I worked for Department of Air Force and youth programs for several years as a youth director, and then I came back east and worked with the Forest Service until I retired. But one of the things that I learned when I worked with youth programs is that a lot of the history, particularly African-American history, was not being told. We're repeatedly talking about the same people, you know, especially during Black History Month, with Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman and Sojourner True. And I just wanted to let our young people know that that African Americans contributed way more than that to make this nation the great nation that it is. And so I decided and put my, well, I won't say I decided, God decided, because it's my new purpose in life. It's to write children's books, and I focus on the little-known people and events in African-American history. My titles are The Leaders Like Us, and it's a collection of biographies of different people in African-American history from the early, you know, 1700s on up to present day. And then I also wrote Black Stories Matter for Hachette UK, and then they were sold over to Crabtree Publishing Company in the United States. And then another series I did was Careers in the U.S. Military, and I had a really, really great time doing that. Because one of the things that I noticed when I went into the military is that, you know, I didn't come from a military background. I had no idea of, you know, what I was getting myself into in terms of careers. You know, I took the ASVAB, and, you know, they said this is the area that you would do well in. But when I when it came time to select my career, I had no idea what they were about. And so I wanted to make sure that our young people knew what careers they were going into. So I talked to the publisher into allowing me to do that series. And then the last one that I did that was released a couple of years ago was Travel to Historically Black Colleges and Universities.
You're a Desert Storm veteran, correct?
I am. Uh-huh.
Thank you for your service, ma'am.
Well, thank you.
Look, we got to go to a break. I want to bring Claude. You got two great names that are like Janice and J.P. Miller. So you know who I'm talking to when I call you Janice or I call you J.P.
Yes.
We're going to go to a fast break and bring you back for a couple minutes on the other side. You're listening to the Welcome Home Show. We'll be right back. Remember, everyone, May 22nd in Wildwood, right in front of the convention hall, in between the Wildwood Convention Hall and the boardwalk, and on the ocean, the beach, and the Vietnam Wall right across the street. Flags ready. We'll be unfolding a few hundred casket flags, interment flags, burial flags, whatever you prefer to call them. Along with the San Jose flag, we'll be flying behind the Vietnam Wall on the center flagpole. And underneath that will be the POW MIA flag. And that's May 22nd online. And you can register at flagsofliberty.elks1896@gmail.com. And there's no fee, no charge. You'll get a pin. You register before the middle of April. You will get a T-shirt with your loved one's name on the back of it and this big emblem of the branch of service they served in. You will get a luncheon. You'll get four tickets for a luncheon that is really, really a great luncheon that they have. There'll be a 25, 30-piece orchestra band there playing patriotic music. And it'll be a great, what a great day to start off the Memorial Day. We ask you to register so we have time to get your name of your loved one put on the back. If you are registering two flags, three flags, or 10 flags, you must do separate registrations. So if you're registering Joe Griffey's, then you have to do that. And then
email again and say Bill Davenport, and then email again Ralph Galati. Then this way you will get a shirt for each one of the flags that we will be presenting that day. But anyway, Claude, once again, give out a number and just real quick, how important is hospice at the end for everyone? But and I think the greatest people God put on earth are the hospice people. They just come in and they take over, take care of a tough situation for a family. And they just take care and they make everything easy for the family. I think they're special or anointed people by God that do that. But give a number, and how important is it that people have hospice set up for when they need it? You know, they have that number.
Well, it's very important. You know, you get to that stage of life, and the medical situation is such that the end is coming. You know, we know that. We can't get away from that eventually. And so hospice is a way to manage that process and try to make it easier for the patient and the family. And basically, you know, our role at Last Patrol is to bring volunteers in that picture. We don't provide the medical care. We don't do the doctor's part of that. We're simply a volunteer network that is out there to bring companionship to our fellow veterans that go into hospice. There are about, Joe, there's about 100,000 veterans every year that go into hospice around America. They're in senior care facilities, private homes, hospitals, places like that. So our volunteers, and if someone wants to volunteer or learn more about us, the best thing is go out to the website, veteranlastpatrol.org, or give us a call. And our number is 864-580-8005. We're about bringing companionship and supporting our fellow veterans on the Last Patrol.
God bless you, my friend. Janice, J.P. Miller.
Yes.
How'd you come up with the name J.P.?
Well, it's actually just my first and middle name initials, so I wasn't too creative with it. But I did get the nickname in college. We were actually studying J.P. Morgan in American history, and so the students just started calling me J.P. Miller, since, you know, I guess same initials, and it kind of stuck. And so I thought, well, that'd be a good pen name to use.
Are you writing any books now?
I am, and I just came off of a workshop last week where I had two editors to request the full manuscript, and so I've been working on that a little bit this morning to prepare that and send it in to them to see if something that they would be willing to publish.
You know, I admire, I love writers. I wish I could write better than I can. I always claim to be the best writer I know of, someone who barely made it through high school. But there's something about writing. There's something that you can get your feelings out differently than speaking. And what's good about writing is when you say something that makes sense and really cool, yeah, if you try and remember it a week from now, what you said, you don't remember it. But if you write it down, you remember it.
Listen, absolutely. You
give a number where people can get your books.
Well, they are actually on Amazon. You can find them on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all the major outlets. You can actually find the books there. And it's Leaders Like Us, published through Carson DeLosa. So is The Careers in the Military, published by Carson DeLosa. And those are some of your top educational publishers. So Black Stories Matter is with Crabtree Publishing. But you can go to my website, and you can also find them there. I don't have the links directly to the publisher on my website, but you can get the title, get a little bit about, hear a little bit about them with the synopsis, and then if you want to order them, you can go to Amazon.
Now, I asked you the other day, do you know my friend Brenda Brown? She just wrote a book.
I did not.
It was her story and all with Liz Fraser and Carmelita Espinoza, who put the movie together, the 6 Triple H, the African American mail carriers.
Right.
And I should remember the name of the book. She sent me a box of them. My little brown mother. Was one of the mail sorters that did a fabulous job. They're finally getting the recognition that they deserve. But listen, we got a phone call coming in that we have to take from Dover. A friend of ours is calling in with the 6 soldiers that are being, I guess, reunited with their families, their loved ones. and we're going to do that. But we will both of you guys come back on again? You know,
sure.
Janice and Claude, listen, God bless you. Thank you for all that you do. And thank you mostly for your service. You know,
all right. God bless
you.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Claude.
Have a great day.
And welcome home, you guys. You're listening to the Welcome Home Show. We'll be right back.
Welcome back, everybody. Today being March 8th, like we do every week, we announce the birthdays and the casualties of the Vietnam War. We do that with the names of those young men. In this case, today they're young men who died in Vietnam on the Washington, D.C. Wall, the Wildwood Wall, and numerous walls throughout the country, with a special comment at the end. Birthdays today would be 174, and three of those from New Jersey. Casualties, 184, with four from New Jersey. We're going to start announcing the seven Coast Guard Coast Guardsmen that died in Vietnam and give them some recognition, because the Cape May County, they're a big deal, and all of them went through boot camp in Cape May County, so they have a second home here. Morris S. Beeson, United States Coast Guard. He was born March 8, 1932, and he died March 22, 1969. He was a career Coast Guardsman. He's from Pitkins, Louisiana. Bruce Heil, United States Army, born November 24, 1949, and he died March 10, 1971. He was from Wildwood. His father was the sheriff. He'll be 21 forever. Let me just jump back to Morris again. He was 37, obviously career. And we want to remember today, the Coast Guard are at the current war and all over the world. They're serving, and they're serving without pay. So remember them if you can. William A. Comley, United States Marine Corps. He was born March 6, 1950. He died March 11th, 1970. He was his connection to Cape May County is he was a Wildwood Beach Patrol member in 1968. He's from Collingswood, New Jersey. And just by chance, I was at a basketball game yesterday, while we're high school, played Haddon Township. And in the, at halftime, I was wandering around the lobby, numerous trophy cases. And just by chance and how things happen, I turn around, I looked in the case, and there's the William Comely Award. Started in 1970, and there's a number of names of students, and the award's given to a student each year that shows patriotism to the school and to their community. And that's just by chance. I'll be—I didn't realize he went to Haddon Township High School. I'll be doing a lot more research. I already have a lot about the young man, but he'll be 20 forever.
Yeah, pretty cool.
Yeah.
Sure, we're going to add that. We're going to talk about them every week.
Yeah, the Coast Guard. Yeah, the seven that died. And they have a connection to Cape May County.
Yeah, anyway, we got a guy I really enjoy. He might be the smartest person I ever spoke to in my life. Jim, are you with us?
This is Jim Ferrigan.
Yeah, Jim Ferrigan. Where are you at now, sir?
I live in Reno, Nevada, and to answer your question where I'm at a Scouting America training for scout leaders on proper flag etiquette, lore, and protocol.
Jim, you may be the smartest human being I ever spoke to. You, because you can ask this guy a question, he'll quote something from a book that he read 40 years ago, and it's word for word.
Some of the flags.
I'm going to try and pronounce. Matter of fact, I'll let you pronounce it. What is your now? You're a rancher. You own a big ranch in Nevada.
Well, my family is involved in ranching. What I do for a living is I am a consulting vexillologist.
Vexillologist.
Vexillology is the study of flags.
But in the meantime, you're still a rancher.
Well, the answer is yes. My family still owns a cattle ranch. Yes.
Bill, now I hope he answers this for me. Can you give us any idea how big your ranch is?
Well, the family's ranch is on a Bureau of Land Management allotment, and the allotment is about 12 miles wide and about 60 miles long. So that's about 350,000 acres. But now we don't own that land. That's our allotment of the public domain. The family only owns about 10,000 acres.
Oh, only 10,000. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Okay.
And I guess no any idea how much cattle is grazing on your... Because I was in the meat business my whole life, and we bought direct from IBP National Montfort, Kansas City.
Well, I believe the allotment permit is for 1,600 head of cattle.
Yeah. Yeah, and boy, it takes a long time to raise your cattle to get it to market, and they got to keep replenishing the herds and this and that.
That's right. But we are but stewards of the range.
Yes. Now, what got you involved in flags?
Well, my father was an executive with the Bethlehem Steel Company in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and he brought some flags home from some ships that were being scrapped after World War II. He gave them to me, and I thought, I was a Cub Scout at the time, I was probably about 9 years old, and I just thought they were way cool, and he gave them to me, and I asked him what they were, and he said that he had no idea, but that there was a library 3 blocks away. So I went to the library, and sure enough, they did have some books on flags in the adult library, not downstairs in the kids' library. So they let me take one book home, and it was called The Observer's Book of Flags by a British author named I.O. Evans. And it started with a little piece of doggerel that said, "A moth-eaten rag on a worm-eaten pole is not very likely to stir a man's soul. 'Tis the deeds that were done neath the moth-eaten rag when the pole was a staff and the rag a flag." And it always just stuck with me that all that information could be packed into a little cloth rectangle.
And how old were you at the time when you first read that? 9?
Yeah, I think it was a Cub Scout.
You know? So it not only got tucked into that flag, all that information got tucked into your little head at the time of 9 years old.
And I just became fascinated. And then I was, in 1960, the Civil War Centennial started. And, you know, flags were in the news. Hawaii and Alaska were becoming states. And so I was just fascinated by all the stuff about flags.
If I throw a couple things out there, can you give us a one-minute version of an answer?
I'll try.
Little Bighorn.
Well, the 7th Cavalry is thought to have taken between 14 to 15 flags into that battle. Now, Custer divided his command into three battalions. He commanded one battalion of cavalry, and it was made up of the companies C, D, you know, or I guess what, C, E, F, L, and I. The Reno Battalion was A, G, and M companies, and the Benteen had B, H, and K, and then a lieutenant with the pack train, which was Company G, all had guidons. And the cavalry was not authorized to carry the United States flag in 1876, so there was no actual United States flag carried into that battle. There were the two guidons, and then the 7th Cavalry Standard, and the personal guidon of George Armstrong Custer. And of the ones lost that day, all of Custer's battalion was lost. G was lost on the valley floor. And then Company H's guidon, I think, was lost up at the Reno Benteen fight.
Did any of those flags ever cross your desk?
No, I've never. I've seen him. I saw a Tom Custer flag when it was at Sotheby's to be sold. That was C Company's flag. And then I've been to Little Bighorn National Monument to see the flags they have up there. They have Company I's flag. Those pieces are all framed, so I've never seen one out of a frame.
So you are a consultant for flags and museums and flag companies. You're a consultant for...
Well, the answer is yes. I consult for...
Annan Flag Company and...
Well, I do consult for Annan. It's a large flag company on the East Coast. I've consulted for museums, the Smithsonian, going all the way back to 1996, and then for private collectors, and then for state governments.
Now, what about St. Patrick's Battalion?
The St. Patricios were a group of... the soldiers had fought on the side of Mexico in the Mexican-American War in the mid-1840s. And the origins of the battalion were some soldiers in the American Army who were Irish and Catholic became dissatisfied with their treatment by the United States Army, which was most of the officers were Protestant, and they were fighting fellow Catholics in the form of the Mexican Army. So some of them deserted and went over to the Mexican side. Perhaps the most famous one was a guy named John O'Reilly. And Riley, John Riley, John and Riley had already been in the British Army in Canada, so he was a very skilled soldier. And the San Patricio probably started as an artillery battery. Then when they got enough volunteers to form a battalion, they were called the San Patricios. And then as their numbers grew, they ended up becoming a part of the Mexican Foreign Legion. The battalion fought valiantly against the American Army at Churubusco, and they lost their colors there, which were captured by the 14th Infantry. And those were sent to West Point. And the flag itself seems to have been misplaced. No one knows where it is. There's no record of it being returned, but West Point Museum doesn't have an accounting for it. Apparently it was around until the 1920s, and it seems to have been misplaced during a remodel of the West Point Chapel. So we really don't know what it looked like. It doesn't seem to have ever been photographed, but it supposedly, based on a newspaper description of it, when it passed through New Orleans, I think it had two different emblems on each side. On one side, it had a harp and a Mexican coat of arms, and a ribbon designating the unit, the St. Patrick's Battalion. And on the other side, it had religious symbols. It had a symbol of St. Patrick and a Celtic cross. And we know that from a couple of different accounts, but all seem to corroborate the basic design. It was a green flag with emblems on both sides.
I want to introduce you, Jim, to Bill Davenport, a Marine Vietnam veteran. He was one of the guys, I guess, 14 years ago, built the Vietnam Wall in Wildwood with the 58,700 names.
Well, it was a pleasure to make his acquaintance on the air.
And we got also, Ralph Calladio, and Ralph spent 14 months in the Hanoi Hilton. He's an Air Force veteran. So, guys, say hello to Jim. Great really, job. Really a fascinating, interesting man. And if
well,
you guys have
you
any
that,
questions...
Joe, I just seem to have read a lot of books about flag.
And remember. You remember everything there. What is that? What I asked you if you had a photographic memory, and you told me no. You have a different kind of memory. What was that word?
Oh, when I was in college, I took a bunch of tests in the psych department, and they said I had an eidetic memory, meaning that I had a good retention of facts that I read.
You know,
E-D-E-T-I-C, eidetic, I think is how you spell it.
Before I turn you over to Ralph and Bill, tell one more short story about, you said, I said, what's a flag that you were involved in, story that you remember that stands out? And you said, oh, Joe, the two flags were in Kennedy's limousine, or Kennedy's convertible, when he got killed. And I asked you, what was he doing with two American flags in his car? So can you share that story real quick?
Well certainly. The collector that I curated his collection, the Zerkor flag collection, which can be found online, Mr. Zerkor, who has since passed, Mr. Zerkor was the... successful bidder of that flag when it came to auction. And there are two flags. It's a set of flags. It's a 50-star United States flag and a 50-star United States presidential flag. And they were on the limo indicating the presence of the President of the United States. When JFK was shot, the limo, of course, sped off towards Parkland Hospital. And the image of the limo careening down the highway with the flags flapping wildly from the right and front fenders because it was burned into the American psyche. And in any event, those flags were turned in by the Secret Service agent driver William Greer to Evelyn Lincoln, Kennedy's private secretary, after the limo was returned to Washington, D.C. and parked safely in the White House garage. And... she in turn conveyed them to a Kennedy Museum so that the flags were under the control of the Kennedy Museum in St. Petersburg, Florida, but they were still, the dominion of them still rested with the United States. So when the museum was going to be, the contents of the museum were going to be auctioned, the National Archives and Records Administration and the Kennedy Foundation got involved to recover some of the things that they felt rightly belonged to them, and then the rest of the property was legally released. Title was transferred, and so the flags could legally be sold, and Mr. Zerko was the successful bidder.
Were you involved in that bidding?
I was. I was involved. I represented Mr. Zerko at the auction. And I believe those are the most important single pieces of material culture left from the Kennedy assassination in private hands. The rest of the material, except for the car itself, which was never property of the United States, that belongs to the Ford Motor Company, but all the other contents of the car, with few exceptions, is all in the hands of the National Archives and Records Administration. All the clothing that everybody wore, and so only some odds and ends have ever come to a public auction. And so these flags, should they ever be released by the Zerkor collection, would probably be, like I said, the most important piece of material culture left from the Kennedy assassination.
Jim, what's the difference between the American flag and the presidential American flag?
The American flag is the... technically, there's no such thing as an American flag. It's the United States flag, and it shows 50 stars on a field of blue, set in a canton on a field of 13 alternating stripes with gold fringe on three sides. The presidential flag, as defined by executive order, is a blue field with a ring, a single ring of 50 stars, in the center of which is the arms of the president, which is the great seal or the lesser seal of the United States. Mm-hmm. The eagle with the motto, "I pluri bathunum," a glory above his head bearing 13 stars. And then, of course, on his breast, the shield of the United States of America.
As you're saying it, I remember seeing that often.
Yeah, you see it on the front. Every time the president makes a speech, it's on the little... originally they were painted plaster. Now I think they're molded plastic, but those, it says "Steel of the President of the United States."
I just wanted our listeners to understand the difference, and it makes a lot of sense.
Ralph, do you have anything? And you know, Ralph, we do it all the time because I think it's... I think especially with Jim Furrigan on our show, he should hear the story from you. And if people heard it before, so be it. We're going to tell it because I think it's one of the most interesting flag stories out there. Jim, Ralph was 14 months in the Inouye Hilton, and he's on the other line with us. He's our partner on the radio show here. Ralph, tell Jim about the experience you had in the Inouye Hilton with the American flag.
Sure, and Jim, thanks for all you do.
You're welcome.
As you know, the significance of the flag, especially the military people that, you know, wear it proudly on their arm, on their uniforms, and, you know, it is the highest form representative of freedom, at least for those of us in uniform. And, you know, its presence is significant, and its absence is equally as significant. And when you're in a POW camp, especially in Hanoi, it's something that you don't see. And, you know, saying the Pledge of Allegiance and things like that were important to you because you still were an American service member. But, you know, having a flag, you know, it was just kind of a gaping hole. And there was a guy, there was a roommate of now deceased Senator John McCain. It was a guy named Mike Christian, and he and two other guys, you know, four in a room, 10-foot square room in the Hanoi Hilton, and Mike Christian decided that it was important to have an American flag. And he took a piece of his bamboo bed and fashioned it into a needle and then started to steal thread from people's clothes and towels and whatever fabric he could find and stitched a crude but effective American flag on the inside of his POW top, his pajama top. And every morning he would take it off and turn it inside out, and he, McCain, and his other roommates would do the Pledge of Allegiance to this rudimentary, crude flag because it was important. And they did that every day, and then one day the North Vietnamese decided to raid the camp looking for contraband, and they found Christian's flag. So they confiscated it, took Christian out, beat him up the rest of the day, threw him back in the cell at night, and told McCain and the other guys, you know, take care of him if you want. We're not going to treat him anymore. If he lives, he lives. If he dies, he dies. So, you know, they had nothing to take care of him with other than a little bit of warm tea and their clothes. But they tried to clean him up as best they could, basically just trying to keep him alive. And later that night, they found him huddled in the corner of the room and figuring he was asleep. But as it turned out later on, Christian would tell people that later that night, he started again with another piece of bamboo from his bed and started to fashion another flag. And when asked about it when he got home, Christian said, I didn't do it for me. He says, My roommates were expecting a flag the next morning to do our Pledge of Allegiance. And I tell that, I try to represent it as best I could because McCain used to tell the story very well. But it was like the extent that you would go to remember your country, to honor your country and the flag, and to show respect for your fellow POWs in that way, you know, totally selfless act of freedom. To me, always stood out as the highest form of respect for the flag, and I appreciate Joe letting me tell that once in a while. Well, thank you so much. That's a very moving story. And, it just goes to illustrate the simple power of symbol. You know, and the thing about the United States flag is our nation really had the first flag that literally belonged to us. It's the first three words of the Constitution, we the people. And there's a lot of angst and different variations and back and forth in the early days of the Republic about what symbol was going to represent us. And, I always tell the scouts that the flag truly belongs to us. We just happen to let our government use it. But it's our flag.
Yeah. Jim, do you know much?
And it's going through some variations, right? Didn't it, at one time, when there was a 14th state and a 15th state, I think they added stripes up until about 15.
They did. From 1818, from 1795 to 1818, the flag officially had 15 stripes. But then a sea captain named Reed suggested that if we kept doing that, because more states were adding, that we would end up with a flag that looked like mattress ticking. And so they suggested that we revert to the original 13 to honor the 13 colonies that became states. And it's important to remember that the first 13 did not join the Union, but rather created it. Vermont and Kentucky joined it, but the first 13, they created the Union. Mm. So that's what the first 13 stripes, or that's what the 13 stripes stand for. And then they would simply add a star on the next 4th of July after statehood for every succeeding state. So we went from 15 officially to 20. But there was a 14-stripe flag. There's a 15-star flag at the Smithsonian. There is a 16-star flag. And there's one known 17-star flag that was captured by the British in the War of 1812 from the American privateer, the Blockade. And so these things did exist, and it would be only until Congress finally formalized that it would be one new star for each state, setting the pattern that we enjoy today.
Jim, hold that thought, and Ralph and Bill, we got to take a fast break. We're going to come back. And when we come back, Ralph and Bill, you guys can chime in also. I'd like to ask you, how much history do we know about, and I don't think it's a lot, but you're the expert on Betsy Ross making the first flag. You're listening to Welcome Home Show. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. WIBG 398-1020, the Welcome Home Show. I'm here with Bill Davenport, Logan Runyon, Ralph Galati, and Mr. James Farragan. I was telling everybody how brilliant this man is. I guarantee he's not reading anything out of a book. He doesn't have a million papers in front of him like I do to remember things. He's pulling these names, these dates, these size of flags, how many stripes, how many stars, what was blue, what was on a horse, what was on a tank, what was on the president's limousine from his memory, and it's great. Jim, what do we know? And we're involved with this Flags of Liberty, where we're going unfolding interment, burial, or casket flags May 22nd, along with the San Jose flag that's traveling now around the United States, and Mary Helen Hough's flag that her daughter Susie's going to bring back here. But what do we know about Betsy Ross and the flag, the size she made? Did she make it for George Washington, or she was a seamstress and an upholsterer? George Washington could have went to her to get a saddle made or a chair in his house reupholstered. What do we know about the flag Betsy Ross made?
The popular story is that Betsy Ross made a flag, the first 13-star flag, at the request of a special committee of the Continental Congress in the spring or early summer of 1776, in time for, the Declaration of Independence. And that story came to us down through the ages, and it was certainly intensified during the centennial in 1876, when George Washington was essentially elevated to sainthood status or demigod status. And in the Victorian era, Betsy provided a convenient female counterpart. And so, oddly enough, her name now is the most recognized name of an American woman from history. Everybody knows about Betsy Ross. So that's the story. The facts are Elizabeth Griscom Ross Ashburn Claypool was a remarkable American woman who ran a business after having been widowed three times during the Revolutionary War. And she was able to keep her family together even during the British occupation in Philadelphia. What we do know is that she was paid by the Pennsylvania government to make flags. But the timeline probably doesn't add up. In other words, the events probably didn't happen in 1776. That was a conceit from the centennial era. And a much likely, more likely scenario is that there was a request in early June of 1777 from the Delaware Indian for a flag of the United States. And probably the Congress decided to honor that request, and so somebody finally pointed out that, well, we couldn't very well give them the flag we were using, which was the so-called Continental Colors or Grand Union flag, because it was 13 stripes with the British flag in the canton. So it was time for a new flag. So at some point, a request was made to have a flag made. We don't know who. I have my own personal theory, but Elizabeth may have been involved in the making of the flag. Whether it was the first one or not, we simply don't know. She was known to have made flags for the government much later, after the Schuylkill Arsenal was established as the principal armory for supplying textile goods to the United States. And then eventually just the army. Originally it was for everybody. And we do know that she made flags well into her advanced age. The story came to us from her grandson, one William Candy. And he was kind of pleading during the centennial, asking, can someone help me with this? Can someone help our family story that my grandmother made the first flag? So, according to the legend, Betsy told him of her actions when he was a little boy. So we have both extremes, the young and the old, telling a story. And I don't think it's hard to believe that a young boy remembered it as my grandma made the first flag. Now, she certainly made some of the first flags. Whether or not it was the very first one, we simply don't know. But she's a remarkable woman. She kept her family together. She, like I said, she was widowed three times. And she was known to have been involved in the flag business. I think she may have been approached by another woman in the flag business, one Rebecca Young, who was known to have made flags in Philadelphia. And she had a connection with the Army Commissary Department because her brother was Colonel Flowers, who was the head of Washington's Commissary Department. I think she probably was so busy making flags during the Revolutionary War that she had to farm stuff out, and she may have farmed it out to Betsy.
Jim,
so that's the difference between the legend and the fact.
Jim, am I safe saying, or are we safe saying, that the flag is probably the most recognized symbol around the world of our country?
Well, it's certainly the symbol everybody thinks of when they recognize United States. In terms of most recognized symbols, you know, the World Book Encyclopedia used to track recognizable world symbols. Certainly the United States flag has always been in the top 10. There are other logos that are non-national or transnational symbols, one of which is, of course, would be the Coke logo.
That's, I was going to say Coca-Cola.
Yeah. In modern times, the Nike swoosh has become ubiquitous. Certainly the Union Jack has wide recognition, and it's even older than the United States flag. But you would be safe in saying that it is one of the top 10 recognized symbols in the world, yeah.
And I'm sure Bill and Ralph have a question, but I got one more I want to ask you. Aren't we lucky that we can call Bob Caggiano a friend at Annan Flight Company?
Well, yes. He's a vice president at Annan Flight Company, and that's the oldest and largest flag company in the country. It was started it was incorporated in 1847. The story goes John Annan saw an opportunity and in the early 1840s bought the first sewing machines. And he was a visionary. He saw an opportunity after Elias Howe invents the sewing machine, Singer improves it, and Annan, or John Annan and the family, acquired them. They had a little shift chandlery business, and they grew into to becoming the largest flag company in the United States, probably one of the largest in the world.
Jim, this is Bill. Earlier,
hi, Bill.
How you doing? Earlier, you mentioned about it's not the American flag, it's the United States flag, but everything we do in reading refers mostly to the American flag. Is this based in law or standard or code?
Well, the legal definition is the United States flag, or conversely, the flag of the United States of America. With the common name or nominative for us is American, and we have run with that. And so it's the popular name is the American flag, but its legal name is the flag of the United States of America,
See that. Americans like to cut things down and eliminate all the unnecessary words. And
well, I'm sure it probably came from the press. You know, they invent a lot of contractions.
Sure.
And certainly the American flag falls into that category. But the problem with the simple descriptor American is that it also includes Texan flags, Confederate flags, they're all on American soil as well. And also a flag, any flag used in America by definition becomes an American flag. Not a national flag, to be sure, but American by geography.
Yeah, and Ralph, is there anything you'd like to ask Jim?
I am just astounded.
Smart man, isn't he?
just his institutional memory. I don't know if you've written a book or intend to write some memoirs, and you know, just to be able to capture all the anecdotes that you've picked up over time, but they would be precious and worth preserving. So thank you.
Well, someday I'd like to. I'll be brutally frank. The arrangement I've had for 20 years with the Zarecourt collection was that I wouldn't publish anything because he considered any research I did on his collection to be proprietary, and so now I'm dealing with the estate. So someday you've given me something to shoot for.
That word that I can't pronounce, I'm not even going to try and pronounce what you're called in the flag business.
I'm a vexillological consultant.
What do you have to be to do that? What qualifications? What?
I don't know. There's no way you can go to school to get a degree in that. But I'll tell you, my background was I was originally a hobbyist. I liked flags when I was a young scout. Eventually, I took a job with a flag company. I was in the trade for 25 years. Then I went and got a teaching credential, and I made flags in education my project. And I did not get a contract. So, coincidence, I ended up correcting some of the errors in their flag exhibition, and the Zarecourt family hired me to help curate their collection, and I've been doing that since 2003.
Do you have a collection of flags yourself?
I did collect flags, but when I started consulting, I stopped because I felt no man could serve two masters. I used to collect flags made where they were, like a U.S. flag made in the United States, a British flag made in Britain, a French flag made in France, a Turkish flag made in Turkey, etc.
Can you tell us some of the, maybe what the most expensive flag that you came across? And they're all expensive. They all have a price tag on it. Six flags are down at Dover, Delaware now, bringing the remains back of our soldiers that we lost. So
certainly the two most precious, priceless flags in the United States are the two flags for Mount Suribachi on Iwo Jima. I don't think you could acquire those flags for any amount of money. So they would fall into the category of priceless. In terms of monetary value, certainly the four flags from the Major General Bannister Tarleton estate sold at Sotheby's, I think, in 2005 for in excess of 17 million, or somewhere around between 14 to 17 million. I can't remember exactly without consulting my notes, but they were flags captured during the American Revolutionary War by a British officer named health. And he had them in his library in England until his great-nephew inherited them, and he brought them to the United States, and they were sold. So that's probably the record of which I am aware. One of George Custer's flags was acquired at a private post-auction deal in Texas in, in the early 2000s, I guess. And I think that one went for just under $1 million. Most recently, a flag from the Battle of Trafalgar just sold at Christie's last summer for $1.1 million. And, of course, that Custer flag I mentioned earlier from Little Birdhorn sold for $2.2 million, also at Sotheby's.
One last question before we have to leave you. Is there a flag or a flag story that you haven't covered yet or you want to cover? It's on your bucket list.
Well, I'll tell you, the answer is sort of. I have become fascinated with the flags used by explorers. In other words, specifically United States flags that were used in some achievement other than war. And I don't mean to put in any way disparage the former, but I don't think they get studied enough, like Amelia Earhart's flag.
Did Lewis and Clark have a flag?
Lewis and Clark took 3 bales of flags on their expeditions, and they were so important that they were sized according to the importance of the chief they would be dealing with. In fact, Elizabeth Ross might have made some of those flags.
Listen, we want to thank Bob Caggiano for introducing us, and he said, Joe, you're going to love this guy. He can go on forever and ever, and one story is better than the next story. And I mean,
well,
Ralph,
I hope your listeners found this interesting. And you know, remember what I think it was Calvin Coolidge said: persistence is always rewarded and never punished.
Yes, and and we're good at that. Ralph, you know, God bless you. And
well, thank you for that story about the Hannah Hilton. I found that very moving, and I thank you for it. In fact, that's a whole different subject. There's flags made in POW camps, liberation flags.
Yeah. You know, and Bill, why don't you take the last word? And
I just want to thank you. And you say you're at a Boy Scout event?
Right now, I gave up eating lunch so I could be on this show. Oh.
Thank you.
But I'm at a scout training in the Nevada Area Council, and I just gave 2 classes, one for Cub Scouts and one for Scouting BSA, on proper flag etiquette, protocol, and lore for the scout leader.
And that would go to their merit badge?
Well, there's no merit badge in flags yet, but it goes towards the requirements in scouting to do flags as part of their citizenship obligation, and also for some of their advancement requirements.
And Jim, let me just correct you on the last thing you said. You said you gave 2 classes today. You gave 3. You gave us a class.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, thank you. Thank you, Jerry. It's been delightful.
Listen, God bless you. We'll be talking to you soon.
Likewise.
And what patriotism you have, sir. You listen to the Welcome Home Show. We'll be back next week. I believe we're going to have Kenneth on, newly decorated 5 years ago. He waited 55 years, Medal of Honor recipient, and just another interesting story about American flags leading up to the Flags of Liberty, the San Jose flag, and the POW flag to celebrate our country's 250th birthday. God bless you, Ralph, Bill. Everybody have a good week and stay safe.